Fibeke,
the podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles and critical believers. RevLab. Herzlich willkommen und schön, dass ihr wieder reinhört bei More Tea Vicar, der Podcast für London-Liebhaberinnen, Menschenfreunde, Glaubensinteressierte und Geschichtsfans direkt aus der britischen Hauptstadt. Ich bin Carla Maurer, Pfarrerin an der Schweizerkirche in London, und ich rede mit Menschen, die im Grossstadtdschungel leben und überleben. Der heutige Podcast ist ganz besonders den Geschichtsfans und Hobbyhistoriker unter euch gewidmet. Zu denen gehöre ich definitiv auch. Als Jugendliche bin ich mal mit meinen Eltern und beiden Schwestern in Bayeux, in Nordfrankreich. Dort hängt der weltberühmte Tapis de Bayeux. Das ist ein 70 Meter langes besticktes Stück Stoff, ist übrigens ein guter Zungenbrecher, besticktes Stück Stoff aus dem Mittelalter, wo die Schlacht von Hastings im Jahr 1066 zwischen den Normannen und dem späteren englischen König darstellt. Man könnte sagen, ein mittelalterlicher Comicstrip. Teenage Carla war so fasziniert von dem Stück Stoff, dass sie ihre Eltern und Geschwister fast in Wahnsinn getrieben hat, bis sie endlich einmal aus dem Museum draussen war. Lustigerweise bin ich heute übrigens sicher einmal pro Monat in Hastings. Zwar nicht wegen dem Tapis de Bayeux, sondern weil dort meine Schwiegermutter wohnt. Das hätte ich damals auch nicht gedacht. Und statt dem Tapis schauen, schwimme ich lieber eine Runde im Meer. Oder ist es Fischbrötli vorne am Strand. Oder trinke ein anständiges British Ale. Ich habe dann auch 2 Jahre lang Geschichte studiert an der Uni Bern. Zuerst habe ich da eher so ein bisschen als Beschäftigungstherapie gemacht, bis ich dann einen Platz in der Schauspielschule ergattern kann. Aber das Unileben und vor allem die mittelalterliche Geschichte, die hat mir so den Ärmel hineingezogen, dass das mit der Schauspielerei irgendwann gar nicht mehr wichtig war. Und das mit der mittelalterlichen Geschichte und der Philosophie, das ist ja so ein bisschen eine Sache. Für das muss man eigentlich fast Theologin sein oder auf jeden Fall sehr viel Wissen in Kirchengeschichte und Bibelkund haben. Ich bin darum sehr schnell an meine Grenzen gestoßen und habe dann ein paar Theologie- und Bibel-Crash-Kurs besucht. Und ab dann hat mich Theologie einfach nicht mehr losgelassen. Pfarrerin wollte ich dann zwar nie werden, weil ich gar nicht an Gott geglaubt habe und mit der Kirche wirklich nichts am Hut hatte. Aber irgendwie sind dann all die Pfaffen, denen ich begegnet bin, ganz tolle Menschen gewesen. Und überhaupt nicht so dogmatisch und engstirnig, wie ich mir das immer vorgestellt habe. Und wie es im Leben so kommt, bin ich dann halt Pfarrerin geworden und ich finde es heute den schönsten Beruf der Welt. Ja, und das mit der Schauspielerei. Das ist ja zum Glück tipptopp mit dem Pfarrberuf zu vereinen. Und so hat wirklich Theater, Theologie und Geschichte irgendwie alles zusammengefunden. Als Pfarrvikare, also wenn man als Pfarrer oder Pfarrerin in der Ausbildung ist, dann wird man ja sogar teilweise, zumindest in der Schweiz und in Deutschland, von Schauspielern ausgebildet. Und ich mag mich noch gut erinnern, wie ich einmal in so einem Kurs als Paulus auf einem Stuhl gestanden bin und ein paar von meinen Studienkollegen, die sind Gemeinde von Korinth gewesen, also sind vor mir gesessen und ich habe dann als Paulus auf meinem Stuhl denen einen Brief verlesen. Und ja, ich habe dann wirklich gelernt, es macht einen grossen Unterschied, wie man sich auf so eine Lesung vorbereitet. Und das merke ich immer dann besonders, wenn ich mal wieder zu faul dazu war. Heute rede ich mit einer Frau, die meine Passion für Geschichte und Theater teilt. Und noch spezifischer, für die Geschichtsschreibung, die nicht in den gängigen Geschichtsbüchern vorkommt. Zum Beispiel Frauengeschichte. Kate ist eines Tages die Endell Street hochgelaufen, also die Strasse, wo die Schweizerkirche dran steht, und hat gerade gegenüber von der Schweizerkirche ein bescheidenes Schild entdeckt. Und auf dem Schild steht «Site of Endell Street Military Hospital 1915 to 1919. established in former workhouse buildings during the First World War, under the command of Dr. Flora Murray and Dr. Louise Garrett Anderson. This 573-bed hospital is the only British Army hospital to have been staffed entirely by women. More than 24,000 soldiers were treated here. Das Schild hat das Interesse von der multimedialen Theaterproduzentin Kate geweckt. Sie hat erforscht, was da für eine Geschichte hintersteckt und hat ein immersives Theaterstück «Deeds, Not Words» produziert. Also ein Theater, wo man sich als Zuschauer beteiligt, wo man wirklich drin ist, fast in einer Rolle. Und mit dem hat sie dann bei der Schweizer Kirche angeklopft und gefragt, ob sie es bei uns aufführen könnte. Ich freue mich sehr, dass Kate heute bei mir zu Gast ist. So, Kate Valentine is the director of the production company Digital Drama, and you are known for unearthing forgotten history and to bring it to life to the public. Hi, Kate, and is that the correct description?
Hi, Carla. Yes, that's a good description. We look for stories that are as yet unheard by the general public, often stories from people whose voice wouldn't necessarily have come to the fore before. So people of colour, women, people from different community groups that wouldn't necessarily have made it into the history books. So for example, working here at the Swiss Church was fantastic, and that came through I would be walking past your door every day, and opposite on the building, opposite, there's a notice on the wall.
And we will talk about this notice and the history of it a bit later. And also maybe to say that's also the reason why I'm talking to you today, because there's something really quite extraordinary happened just on the doorsteps of the Swiss Church opposite. We will hear about this forgotten piece of history. The reason also why I talk to you is because I'm a history enthusiast, and especially about women's history. And whenever I walk up Endell Street, the street where the church is located, I feel the ghosts of the past. And because I just love history, it's really fascinating. So before we approach those ghosts of the past in Endell Street, I wanted to ask you how you are and how the theatre world is, because after the lockdown, theatres haven't reopened yet in London. What does that mean for your company, and what is your prediction for the future for the theatre world in London?
It is pretty devastating. It's really sad. Overnight, obviously, income was just slashed for theatres, for theatre companies, for all the freelancers who work for them, for all the box office staff, and also for the companies that are around theatres. So I've just walked through from Waterloo to here at the Swiss Church. And there are so many of the smaller cafes and shops and restaurants that aren't open, because there's no point if they haven't got 3,000 people watching The Lion King of an evening. So it's the pool of people who are suffering from this, over and above, obviously, what they might have experienced with COVID-19 themselves, is really worrying. And some companies have managed to get the furlough from the government, but because a lot of people are self-employed within the industry, they've fallen between the cracks and not been able to get any support. So it's really important that both the government continues to support it, but also people, as soon as they can, buy tickets or support companies and theatres that they like. We're already moving towards experiences more. And when we talk about it, I'll explain the performance that we did here in the church, which was very much an experience rather than a traditional sitting in rows of seats facing forward. So I think there's a real thirst for that, especially in younger audiences. You know, people say that the sort of 20 to 30 something audiences, they don't have much money to spend on capital things like buying goods, but they do like to have an experience with their friends. So if you can give that to them in a way that is both fun to do, but also good quality. I think that's one of the problems I come across, is it's either one or the other often. Then production companies will do really well out of this.
It does fill me with confidence to hear you saying that, because I love going to the theatre and I do miss it very much. So I understand that I just have to look at different kind of performances rather than waiting for the performances as we use them coming back.
So, Kate, you mentioned a sign that you saw one day walking up Endell Street that is opposite on those the council block that it is now, a sign that says what?
It says, on this location was the first hospital ever run by women. So it was a military hospital in the First World War that was set up by Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray. And I thought, wow, I didn't know that. And I, like you, like women's history. So I thought, there's a project on that. So we researched it further. And after some time and gathering project partners together, we were able to do a project about it. The building, as you just mentioned now, that is currently there, is called Dudley Court, and that was built in the 1970s. But up until then, it was a Victorian, big, big Victorian building, also around a courtyard, in the same way that the flats are now. And it had originally been a workhouse.
So two women ran that hospital.
Yes.
That was probably fairly unusual. Were there any obstacles for them to set up a hospital in during the First World War?
There certainly were. So at the beginning of the war, they were both surgeons. They'd worked, or they were both doctors who had worked, only been allowed to work with children and women, because that was the law at the time. But they felt they had something to give, and then they could see that there were going to be a lot of military personnel who are going to need assistance. So they offered their services to the government department that was dealing with that. And rather patronisingly, they were told to go and knit socks. Not put off by this, they decided to offer their services in France. So they went over and they set up, I think, off their own backs, a field hospital in Paris. So it was taking people who had been injured and were coming back.
So their aim was really to help injured soldiers and to help that kind of incredible need of medical care that was increasing by the day, I guess.
Yes. By 1915, the powers that be in England saw that they needed more help. So actually said, would you come back and do the same thing?
Right. So they came back from Paris and finally were allowed to work, to treat men.
For the first time. And they had surgeons from across the world who were very excited to have that opportunity. They had 600 beds and a staff, mainly of women, of 180 staff. Young girls signing up as nurses who'd never been nurses before, which was not dissimilar to the whole of the war effort. And over the next 4 years, they treated 26,000 people and performed over 7,000 surgical operations.
That's incredible. So suddenly that was possible.
Yes.
Because of the war.
Yes, because of the war. And often medical science progresses, sadly, during wartime. Yeah. Because there are more people to experiment on. But this certainly, for the while, progressed women in medicine. Unfortunately, like a lot of different jobs after the war, it went backwards for a while.
And I think they also did quite a few innovations at the military hospital in wound treatment, I think.
They did, absolutely, to stop sepsis. And that was a big breakthrough found in that hospital. So that was great going forward.
What did the wounded soldiers think about being treated by women? They came back from the front, from the trenches, and they found themselves in a hospital entirely run by women. So certainly that must have raised a few eyebrows.
Well, I don't want to speculate, but I think they probably liked it, because I think maybe the care side might have been a bit more understanding. And certainly from the pictures that we've got from the archive, the way that their wards were set up, so they used to be decorated at times of festivities. There's some lovely pictures of them being decorated with blossom, and that the the long-term soldiers who are there are dressed up in fancy dress as penguins for some bizarre reason. So, you know, as you know, here in Endell Street, we're very close to a lot of the major train stations for London. So that's why it was so popular a place that people would come from the coast, mainly straight in on the train and be transported. But the women had incredible strength, because two of them would pick up a stretcher with a grown man on it. And these stretchers were not made out of aluminium. They were heavy, heavy wooden structures. And they would come all time of day or night. And we used the diaries that we found in the women's library at LSE. And there are some fantastic memories of nurses being so tired that to get a break, they would go and sit on the top of a bus and fall asleep, because that was the only way they were going to get a break.
So and I think they're offered theatre tickets, but they'd rather
go to sleep.
Go to sleep on a bus.
So I think Louisa and Flora were, they ran a tight ship here. There was no room for being queasy or slacking in any way.
They probably had to prove much more as well. They had to prove that women can run a hospital. I mean, that's a lot of weight on their shoulders.
Absolutely. I can't remember the direct quote, but it was, we have to do what men do, but we need to do it better, to balance out the scales.
And yet the hospital was closed. They also treated a lot of victims of the Spanish flu, I think, since the end of the war, which people weren't really aware what it was. It just suddenly, there was this weird flu and they had sick people in the hospital. So it ran for a bit longer, but then, although it was very successful and extremely well run, it closed down. And what happened to the women who worked there and to the two doctors?
Well, tragically, some of the nurses died of the Spanish flu. So they had been working, you know, with the patients all the way through, and then they caught it themselves. And for Louisa and Flora, unfortunately, they didn't go on there to run another hospital. They retired effectively by the 1920s. They were in the countryside and they were very close friends, so they had that support of each other. Their new knowledge and their verve and their enthusiasm was only to be repeated many, many years down the line when women started to be accepted more in mainstream medicine.
So there are many women in professions during the First World War. They had to leave their positions and make space for the men who returned from the front.
They did. Yeah. They did. And that didn't necessarily work either. Another project we did some years back now was looking at how people who were made disabled in the First World War, when they went back to the jobs that they had before, obviously wouldn't necessarily be able to do those jobs because they had no mobility or they had lost a limb, etc. So there was a real move to try and fit the job to the person rather than the other way around. But as you can imagine, the men got that priority. So a lot of, especially younger nurses who had seen, you know, such horrors and dealt with things so brilliantly on a ward, then had to go back either to being, you know, the daughter of somebody and get married and that was it, or into domestic service, which was obviously a very popular job then. Even though it made huge steps forward, like a lot of things in history, then it took a few steps back before it could get better again.
Still so many years or even decades earlier than anything that happened in Switzerland. Obviously the two doctors were also known as, they were also suffragettes, active suffragettes. I don't know if you're familiar with the voting right of women in Switzerland, which was introduced very late.
I do know that.
So any introduction of women's voting right seems late in general, because it should never have been that way in the first place. But if you think of Switzerland, obviously for us, that's great to hear that it happened so much earlier in other parts of Europe. You wrote a play that you showed at the Swiss Church, an immersive experience of the history of the Endell Street Military Hospital. Do you know anything about the connection of the Swiss Church and of that hospital? And how did you go about with your research? And
I didn't write it, I directed it, but it was a play that we used both community actors and professional actors, and we recreated the hospital ward within the Swiss church, because if anybody who's been here knows that it's the most fantastic open space that can be adapted to all sorts of different performances. So what we did was we had our audience were also involved in the performance. So our audience, when they came in, were given white coats and were told by one of the actors. So we only had 30 audience members at a time. In fact, it would have been good now in this COVID times. We were ahead of it. They were given a white coat and they were told that they were inspectors for the day and that they were going to go around this church, and that if they heard any suffragette tendencies coming out, that they had to report it, and that they were there allegedly to make sure that the hospital had enough funds. So the audience were already connected in a way to the performance, and the performance happened as a promenade, so everybody on their feet, and we divided up the space so that we went from the laundry room. We were introduced to a key character who was a nurse in the laundry room who had, you know, her knuckles of red raw from doing the laundry, and she was the character who spoke about going to sleep on the top of the bus. And then we met surgeons, and finally the play opened up onto a ward of six men in their beds, and the audience were invited to go and stand around the beds and listen to the stories of the men and where they'd been, which was great because some of the audience started talking to the men, and that was really, that really tested the knowledge of the actors.
So it was so immersive that the participants or the spectators thought that they were actually really the wounded soldiers.
Yeah, and they could talk to them, and the soldiers in character, or the actors in character, had to improvise their answers. Like, where was I shot down? But luckily, we'd done a lot of research, so it was great. And so we could. It was a short play. It had music in it and projections, and we actually repeated the play, I think it was 7 times in a day and a half. So you can imagine by the end, you don't know whether you're coming or going. I even had to be in it at one point, which was pretty scary because one of our actors had to go off for something else, emergency. So I literally put the hat on and the skirt and my best Cockney accent. I was there. But at one point, when you say the connection of the spaces, must have been the other way around, because one point we had the big front doors that you have here open, and we had a bell ringing, and we had the men on the stretchers outside, and all of the orderlies and the nurses ran out to get them. But of course we had production team out there, but unfortunately it did worry some people passing by. They thought really that there was some bodies on the floor, and we had to kind of go, it's okay, it's a play. So I'm sure that would have happened the other way around, and that people who were visiting the church at that time would have had the same. They would have had bodies going through
to the hospital, and hearing the bell ringing.
That's right.
Maybe even during a Sunday service, there might have been casualties arriving from Charing Cross, and bell ringing and a lot of movement outside the church.
So. And possibly some of the your congregation joining up to help at the hospital. And there's one thing I really like from the photographs, there's extensive photographs of the place, is that you can see in the courtyard that there are trees that are only about 12 foot high to sort of 3 meters high or something. And now those trees are huge and they're still in that courtyard. So it really shows the sense of time, because the workhouse that the hospital had been put in has gone, and it's, as I say, a 1970s development, so very different architecture. But the courtyard and the trees remain the same.
To end with, to come back to the workhouse, so that's going back a bit further in history. Again, that was, the Swiss church was already here, and opposite, before the Ender Street Hospital was opened, it was a workhouse. Now, a lot of our listeners in Switzerland may not be familiar with the institution of the workhouse that were really quite important in London in the 19th century. Could you explain what a workhouse is?
I'll try. I'm not an expert. I'm a director, not a historian, but I'll try. Workhouses were for people who were really, really poor and had no family to support them. We didn't have any system of support for people like we do now. The welfare state wasn't brought in until 1950s. And so they were divided, men and women, and often the children were taken away even from the women. And they were notoriously nasty places to be. I think maybe to encourage people to work harder and better their luck. But that didn't necessarily help because you're in a sort of spiral of poverty. And the workhouse opposite you, where the hospital was afterwards, allegedly is where Charles Dickens placed Oliver Twist in his workhouse. But I think there's a few workhouses that claim that. I think that's on the tourist trail.
Yeah.
But if people are familiar with Oliver Twist or the film Oliver, they'll know that, you know, children and gruel, and that they were either working there or they were sent out to work and then returned there in the daytime. So
Very often was a last resort because it wasn't a pleasant. You had to work hard for a thin bowl of soup and a filthy bed for a night.
That's right.
And that's really, if you really didn't know anymore how to feed yourself, you would go and knock on the doors of a workhouse. Anyone could be admitted, right? You could knock on the door and they would take you in for the night for days of hard labour.
I think so. But again, you'd be split up from your family. And I think people would rather do anything than go there necessarily.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you. Good luck.
I think your way of producing theatre will be the theatre of the future and will not only survive COVID, but I think maybe thanks to COVID and the whole health crisis, maybe even thrive. And I will definitely look out for a similar place and hopefully see one of yours very soon.
Thank you. Well, thank you for inviting me to be on your podcast, Carla.
How do you do? Pleased to meet you. I am Dr. Flora Murray. I understand that you represent the War Office Hospital Funding Committee. And I hope, when I have shown you our work today, that you will agree how badly further funds are needed. One principal reason for the application is to increase our staffing. Just 180 staff for 573 beds means that many are working more hours than can possibly be healthy.
But Dr. Murray, you do have a large volunteer workforce. Oh,
volunteers are invaluable, Colonel. In the gardens, the library, for entertainments. They make tea and work wonders for the men's morale. But Colonel, they cannot replace doctors, nurses, quartermasters.
Endell Street ist voll von Geschichte und Geschichten. Eins der Opfer vom berühmt-berüchtigten Frauenmörder Jack the Ripper, Polly Nichols, soll auch mal im Workhouse gegenüber der Schweizer Kirche Unterschlupf gesucht haben. Seine Opfer waren immer Frauen, die in der Armutsspirale gefangen und häufig obdachlos waren. Wenn man die Endell Street runterläuft, kann man also heute noch die Geister der Vergangenheit spüren. Für einen Geschichtsfan wie mich ein Paradies. Ich hoffe, die drei Episoden mit der Emily Rose, dem Andy und der Kate haben euch gefallen. Und wir sind bald zurück mit mehr. RevLab.